Welcome, everyone. I'm your host, Dean. The Pope this week decided to step down. And he also decided to turn in his big hat. We're saying he quit.
You're listening to the Stuff Smart People Like podcast. We think it's smart. So should you.
To kick things off, I just want to go around the panel and introduce everyone. To my right is Ben. Ben can be followed on Twitter at Mr. Ben. That's Mr. with an H.
Hey, everybody. I like being on Twitter way too much.
To my left is Ed. Ed can be followed on Twitter at Edomaniac. That's Egomaniac with an upside down G.
That's right, folks. I am here to deliver the state of the podcast address.
And straight up the middle is Jim. Jim can be followed on Twitter at Jim Marcus. That's Jim like your earthworm, Mark like your grade, and us like you and I.
Hi, everyone. I'm officially stepping down and will no longer be your Pope.
Popecast.
Popecast.
And finally, I'm Dean once again, and I can be followed on Twitter at The American Dean. Let's get into some headlines. So, Ben, you're first in the headlines. Here's one from the New York Daily News. Mm-hmm. Carnival Triumph air quality, a health hazard, experts say. If you were going to guess what the biggest health hazard on a cruise ship was, what would it be?
Let's see. The biggest health hazard. Probably. Man, I don't know. Everything on a cruise just seems kind of awful in general. So I think just boat problems. I don't know.
How about putting somebody in a big enclosed space and just giving them an all-you-can-eat buffet? Like not giving them anywhere to go.
Just giving them right. A ton of food. Just trapping them with thousands of other people they really don't like.
And then making sure the toilets don't work.
Yeah.
I've always thought dysentery. That falling off the side would be a big hazard of being on a boat in the middle of nowhere.
Mm. You know, for the
no, that's absurd. No one falls off boats.
On a... No, I know. Well, no, I just think about this. Like, if you know, the vast majority of these massive superliner things, the deck is very little of it, and you know, most people probably aren't going out the port side. I hope so. That's my assumption there.
All right, moving on.
I think the food is the worst part.
Yeah, that.
Yeah, it's the food. Everyone can agree. Moving on, Ed. Ed, this is a headline from the Wall Street Journal. It says, Apple may lose iPhone naming rights in Brazil. If you were going to take away the most unimportant part of a product, what would you take away? And what country
of
would you
do? Of any product? Well, let's stick with the iPhone. What's the most unimportant product of part of the iPhone? Wow, that's a tough question.
These are tough questions you have today.
Give me a second here.
Sure,
okay.
Sure. We cut all
what,
this out.
What is the most unimportant part of a product that I would cut out, and which country would I do it in? Mm-hmm. I would cut the French from French fries, and I would do that in the U.S. because I just think it's kind of a misnomer. And, you know, do you really need the French? I mean, everybody just says fries anyway. So.
It's true. I think that's a fine answer.
Let's just drop the French. Yeah. No freedom fries, none of that crap, just fries.
Right.
Works. Right.
Ooh, the French don't
We're not confused
French
by
fries.
What they are.
Yeah, there's like 1,000 other modifiers. You know, you got waffle, crinkle, you got seasoned, right.
Sweet
got
potato.
Ranch, yeah, sweet potato.
Right. Matchstick.
So we don't need the French anymore. French doesn't mean anything in the context of fries. So.
Sure, absolutely. Well, and how many French people do you know that eat French fries?
I don't know any French people.
Exactly.
Pourquoi pas? If they did, they might.
I'm pretty sure fries are popular in France, but
they don't call
them
French
with
fries.
Mussels.
You know,
it's pretty good.
That's racist. We don't know that fries are popular in France. All right, Jim, here's a headline for you. It says it's from Fox News.
Ooh, my favorite.
And it says, Earth-buzzing asteroid worth $195 billion. If you were going to put a price tag on something that you could never get to, what would it be? How much would it be worth?
Ooh, fair question. $195 billion, I think, would have to be the price tag, because that, again, is already the market rate for things we can't reach. And I'm going to go with, well, I don't know, what is the...
Love.
Aww. Oh, human interaction. Oh. Yeah. Yeah, we're going to go with that.
Here's one for you, Dean.
All right.
Did Tyrannosaurus Rex look like Barney? College kids get it wrong.
What?
I feel like you could go on a rant about this, Ed. So,
yeah, I probably could. So what basic understanding of the world would you expect that the college kid would get wrong, other than thinking that they look like Barney? And what would you do to possibly fix it?
This is a very good question, and one I've been ruminating on for some months now. So I feel like I have a pretty good answer here.
We'll be the judge.
I feel like college students nowadays don't know what a... and so I think that that would be...
In conclusion.
Well said.
I don't know.
Did I miss something? Did you actually say something?
No, I didn't say anything.
Okay, you cut out.
I see. I would say that the college students may not know what the moon looks like, and in order to do it, I would make them watch Hours of the Honeymooners, so they can get an idea of what it looks like and how to get there.
That kind of reminds me. There was actually a couple of things on Girls. There was that bit about one of the most recent episodes, one of the main characters was saying, I want to learn how to write a check. Like, that's something kids can't
that's
do.
That's funny.
Mm-hmm.
Write checks.
Accurate.
Did you guys have, like life skills classes where you had to learn that stuff? I did.
Did you?
Yeah, I had a class in eighth grade.
Oh.
Eighth
oh,
grade,
eighth
actually.
Grade. That's why.
Where we had, like, a fake checkbook, and we had to, the teacher would literally say, okay, you know, you get your check for your expenses for this month, and now you have to pay for the phone bill, and it's this amount of money, and you have to pay for your rent, and it's this amount. And we'd have to write checks to her, and then she would check our checkbook to make sure that our numbers added up.
Ooh, that's wait, really did you all smart. Have the same expenses?
Balance a checkbook even.
Yeah,
well,
yeah, literally, like, we had a folder.
That's
that was our checkbook.
Home Finance 201.
Did you all have the same expenses? Like, did you all have the same, like, housing expenses and everything?
Yeah, it was the same for the whole class. So, I mean, it would have been really easy to cheat off somebody, I guess, but, you know, it was basic math, so it wasn't that difficult at eighth grade. But, right. You know, it's the reason I got a nice 401k now. You know what I mean?
Of course.
Yeah, my, I've heard my wife talk about having classes like that. I never had any classes like that in school. And I have always felt like there are huge blind spots that I have. Or that I had to overcome at, you know, once I became an adult, you know, based on that. Because, I don't know, you don't think about a lot of that stuff when you're a kid. Who cares?
I'm guessing checkbooks weren't one of those things that you've had trouble with since becoming an adult.
Well, I didn't have trouble with it, but it was certainly something I had to go, what do I do with this? I've never used one of these before, you know?
Fair.
I don't know. I don't know if I recall ever having like a class like that. I mean, we obviously had like home ec type stuff, but I just picked that up from my parents, and they just like showed me how to do things. Like I was maybe just inquisitive enough to be like, "What are you doing?"
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And they actually showed me. They were just like, "Writing a check, asshole, get away." They were like, "Here, I'm doing
adult
this
stuff.
Thing. You write your name,
right.
Yeah.
Right.
Go drink your juice and watch Barney."
Yeah, right.
I don't know. I feel like I may have been one of those
like
kids
keeping a roof over
who,
your head.
Like I got the gist of something, but I didn't necessarily inquisit about it much. You know, I just like, oh, okay, that sounds good. Yeah, I know you got to pay bills, I guess. Whatever.
I think our school had...
Here's my Lego.
One specific class where they gave that type of exercise, but they took it one step further, and you had to draw out of a hat what your career was with your annual salary, and then they gave you... Everyone got a copy of the newspaper, the Grand Rapids Press, and you had to find a place to live on your salary. You had to find a car to get to your job. And you had to make all of it work for the year, and that was your assignment.
Wow.
I thought it was really helpful.
That's really cool.
Yeah, I had to do a thing like that where you got to like choose your profession and stuff. I don't remember. It was at a different school. It wasn't at my school. It was some sort of weird, I don't know, it probably was like a weekend thing or something, but yeah, it was the same kind of idea. And you had to, I think I was like, I drove a motorcycle because that's all I could afford. Because I was like a starving artist.
Were you also in Michigan? Did you just not work in the winter?
Yeah, really.
Yeah. I did that.
I live dangerously.
I did that a few times, I guess, with my parents. We would sit down and there's this board game called The Game of Life. And
I think I've heard of that.
You have to choose your profession and, you know, fill your car with babies.
Yeah.
So I meant that to be funny, and it got sad.
Loneliness.
Right, a dream deferred is a dream denied.
Headlines. So what's a real natural way of getting into these conspiracies? Yeah,
I think you mentioned something about people not knowing what the moon looked like.
Yeah,
I think that's a great segue.
People don't know what the moon looks like, and guys, have we even been there?
I've heard some say no.
Actually, I was just there was a I didn't watch the video, but I saw the headline recently. They were talking to this guy who was an effects guy, and he was saying it would have been easier to go to the moon at that time than to fake the moon landing, like because of the effects it would have required.
Which is weird, because they went to the moon after 2001 came out, when they actually showed the moon pretty realistically on camera.
Yeah.
Well,
so
I actually watched the video. I know
you did see that video
you're talking about. Yeah, and I actually watched it. And his, I mean, knowing nothing about how, you know, film works, like the actual taking, you know, footage and cutting it together and stuff like that, knowing nothing about how all of that works, his explanations seem realistic. They seem logical. Mm-hmm. But, I mean, for all I know, he could be selling me as much of a bill of goods as the people, you know, claim that the government is. You know what I mean?
Right.
So,
yeah.
But, I mean, it does make sense. He talks about the fact that it's the shutter rate, or the, not the shutter rate, the frame rate at which they filmed. If they had filmed it like faster or something, there just wouldn't have been anything to store that. They just didn't have the capability to store that much data if they filmed it the way that conspiracy theorists say that they did. And there are a number of things like that. He talks about the shadows on the moon, and how if they were in a soundstage, there would be different types of shadows, which I don't know if I buy, because I feel like if you're a pretty good technician, you know, effects technician, you would know how to, you know, light something so that it casts the right shadow.
Right.
But he makes a pretty good argument. He's kind of a dick, too. So, you know, it's this sort of, well, obviously this isn't, you know, it wasn't faked because of this and this and this. So, I don't know, that kind of turned me off a little bit about the video, but he makes a good case, and his logic seems sound, not knowing anything about, you know, what he does or how that would work. So,
Interesting.
Yeah. It's I want to talk about faked footage. That actually just jogged my memory. There was, I think I found this just through, again, my addiction of Twitter. And there was this hoax video that someone had put out claiming to have shot UFO footage. And the real trick of it was not that the UFO was fake, but the entire video was completely CG. But the thing was that it had gone around for almost an entire year as sort of this fake footage, but nobody even questioned any of the other environmental effects around it. The entire thing was done just using computers, which is pretty cool. So I have a link to that too. It's a pretty neat video when you watch it within the context of like the car door opening, and the perspective is completely all artificial. But I mean, it's really neat to be able to trick people into seeing things. I mean, obviously that's today, not, you know, 40 years ago, but
sure.
One of the things that kind of made me think about this and kind of ties into some other kind of recurring themes in our podcast, though, was I think a lot of people's skepticism is not entirely like unfounded, but I think it's another good reason why we deserve, or people deserve, open access to research, so they don't necessarily think that there's a filter or that there's some other ulterior motive to what gets published or what doesn't, or mm-hmm. how the methods are controlled or disclosed or all that kind of thing. I think that's one of the sort of good things you can sort of pull from kind of cuckoo ideas.
I like the idea of a more open environment, more access to research, more public knowledge. But I think the conspiracy theorists out there, given more information, will just have more mm-hmm. information to twist.
Yeah, I kind
develop
of agree
a more
with
complicated story.
Right.
But it may let the skeptics at least point at it and say, no, you're just, you know, the more complicated your explanation is, the better it could be more convincing, but probably is going to just confuse people more, right? So like if I say, oh, if they faked the moon landing and I have like these two pieces of information to say that they did, right? It's like, well, mm-hmm. I don't know anything about it, so that seems plausible. But if I've got like 13 pieces of information and I have to link each one to it in some way, and then this happened and then that thing happened, and you know, the more complex it is, the more I have to weave all those contradictory, potentially contradictory things into it, mm-hmm. possibly the more skeptical people would be of that conspiracy theory, right? Mm-hmm. Less convinced. Yeah. I could be wrong, but that'd be one counter argument to that.
Yeah. It's always just an interesting sort of way to sort of test. For at least for me, part of my fascination with them is how it sort of tests what I know and the finding of fact. Because I don't, you know, live and work in academia, so I'm not necessarily doing that sort of pursuit on my own with my own research or anything. But the idea that people think that, you know, the moon landing was fake, or that there's some overt reason as to why evolution theory is so dominant. Mm-hmm. Like there's some sort of bizarre or ulterior motive to why this overwhelming mountain of evidence is out there refuting their claims,
right.
is still kind of an interesting thing. And it's one of the few times that people, I think, you know, kind of get to watch bad ideas get shot down in sort of a public space. I don't know. Maybe that's just my experience. Yeah. But
well, Ben, I don't know. It's an interesting thing. I don't know if you're like this or if you other two guys are like this at all, but I find myself desperately wanting to believe in conspiracy theories. Like I really want, you know, some sort of big, you know, Da Vinci Code conspiracy to be true.
Like a unifying, like, haha.
Yeah, exactly. That explains everything. That sort of a situation. I really want that to be true. And I obviously, mm-hmm. you know, my rational self is going, well, no, of course not, you know, but how much fun is that? Like, I get why people get sucked into them. I get sucked in, you know, a little bit, and then I'll, like, remind myself, no, this doesn't make sense because, you know, well, just, I mean, take the moon landing and a number of other things that the government's supposedly involved in. Like, the government can't decide on, you know, what we were talking about last week. They can't decide on who should get taxed for what. You know, how are they going to decide, you know, as an entity that we're gonna fake this thing? You know, I don't buy that the government is that efficient.
Yeah, well, and there's also, I mean, the one thing that is more apparent to me now that I'm older, and maybe this is just because I'm older and it's not a recent development or anything, but anytime something happens now, there are people out there are questioning it, which is a great thing, I think, right? So this example with Dorner recently is a good example, right? As soon as the house burns down, right, and this stuff happens, immediately they're questioning, did police act appropriately in this situation, mm-hmm. right?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, maybe if this happened 20 years ago, it would be like, okay, cop killer's dead, move on,
right?
Right? Mm-hmm. There would be less of this concern. And so maybe conspiracy theories are a little less likely to happen and would be harder for a, you know, seedy government to pull off, if you know, in today's world than before because of that.
Hmm.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, that's true.
Right.
And I think the same can be said about like the Catholic Church child sex abuse cover-ups.
Yep.
Right.
I think that kind of skepticism is what led kind of public outrage when it was mm-hmm. discovered to be, oh, this is real. This isn't just, you know, the ravings of a lunatic who wants to see a conspiracy theory true.
Right.
I think that's what brought a lot of priests to justice.
And to be honest, I'm glad those people are there.
Not that many.
Yeah. No,
I'm
for sure.
glad that those skeptics are there and that they're not me, because it'd just be exhausting to always be like,
be
what's going on
shoulder.
Here? Who's
yeah.
doing this?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah. Because it does take a paranoid person to right. be so, like, so skeptical, you know? Mm-hmm. And it's not that, you know, you have to wonder how many of the little facts in these grand conspiracies are actually true. Mm-hmm. Do you know what I mean? Like, right. like what, maybe something was misreported, say, about the moon landing, and these guys discovered, you know, that this little thing was misreported. Mm-hmm. But that doesn't necessarily lead to this big,
right.
Right.
Well, thing. That's definitely true. Like, take, for example, the moon landing. I don't know why we're hovering around the specific one, but it's a good one. But, like, the moon landing, some people say, oh, well, these shots aren't right because X, Y, or Z. And it's explained because in a lot of publishing of these photos, they were edited in certain ways. Like, they take the crosshairs that you see in a lot of the original photos. They were, you know, formatting the crosshairs so they weren't as obvious mm-hmm. to kind of, you know, be more affecting or this, that, or the other thing.
Mm-hmm.
And there were even some instances, I think, in some publications that were, like, tweaking foreground, background type things. I don't know. I'm not even going to pretend that I know specific mm-hmm. examples. Mm-hmm. But, you know, it's one of those where the publishing business was kind of getting in the way of the fact-finding missions
sure.
of these people.
Right.
Not, you know.
Well, and with something like the moon landing, I mean, you know, a person like myself would think there have to be people, you know, that are you know, on both sides of this debate that are, like, fervent enough about it that mm-hmm. you'd figure there would have come to some kind of conclusion by now, right? Like, it would have just been, like, front page news.
Wait, there,
moon landing was not fake. Conclusive
there
evidence.
There is, like, but or, yeah. wait, we can't give credibility to the idea that the moon landing wasn't, like, was faked. Like, this has been disproven over and over again. The
right.
So
the
why
tenacity,
doesn't it die, then?
The tenacity of conspiracy theorists is just that. They don't care about mm-hmm. having the answers to all of their questions. They just think that's part of the cover-up.
Well, like, doesn't it go to, like, selective fact-finding as well? Like, sure. Finding facts to fit your own narrative? What is that called? There's a term for that.
Confirmation bias.
Yep.
Yeah. Yeah. Here's an interesting story. So the... I was just teaching about influence in my class today, and we were talking about cults, mm-hmm. and I didn't know this, but I thought it was a funny story. The Heaven's Gate people who believe that there was a spaceship trailing behind the Hale-Bopp comet, mm-hmm. they believed that because there were some initial reports that had said there was they thought they had detected some sort of object in its trail, like in its wake, right? So they believed that it was the spaceship. So they went out and bought this really expensive telescope to try to see it, right? They get it back, look at it. There's no object back there. Go to the store. Hey, guy, what's wrong with your telescope? We can't see this thing that's back there. The guy says, no, that was actually erroneous. That was an early report, and it was just a problem with their initial view. There's no thing back there. And what do? They return the telescope, and they go home and commit suicide. So, you know, they stuck with their beliefs even after they got that disconfirming evidence, right? It must be the telescope that's wrong,
right.
Not our beliefs. So it doesn't matter for a lot of these people what you throw at them. They're going to, you know, they're going to double down even and be that much more convinced. Well, the reason you want to convince me is because you're part of the conspiracy.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah, absolutely. Right. Like, it's just a wormhole that keeps going and going and going.
Right.
There's a couple of really good ones. First of all, this, I think, is a good time to recommend a book that you guys should check out, or anybody who's listening should check out. It's called Rule by Secrecy by a guy named Jim Mars, M-A-R-R-S. And it is pretty comprehensive look at sort of a lot of different things that you might hear people who are very sort of involved in conspiracy theories talk about, like the Trilateral Commission, the Council on Foreign Relations, you know, obviously JFK, what else? Oh, the Bilderbergers. The IMF and Federal Reserve, the, you know, like, obviously the unifying global economic control. What
sure.
else is there? And then it goes even further back to the Rosicrucianism, mm-hmm. The French Enlightenment, the Jacobins. It's really, really cool, and it goes way, way, way back. It covers everything, and it does so in a pretty, even though it's not obviously real, you want to talk about a sort of unifying theory of things, it's pretty comprehensive, and it creeps you out, but it makes you feel good in that way. It's like, now I got a lock on it. Now I know why my life sucks. Or now I know why things in the world are the way they
that's
are.
Exactly that's exactly what I'm talking about, Ben. It's like, wouldn't it? I mean, I don't know about you
discovered
guys.
The Matrix.
Always looking for an answer as to why things aren't, you know, perfect or whatever. You know, like, oh man, if I only. How come I'm not making $1 million in my 20s already? You know? Oh, there's got to be something to it. Oh, there's a conspiracy against me. See, it wasn't anything I did. You know, it's that sort of a...
Lets you off the hook.
Yeah, exactly. Do you guys ever catch yourself, though, with things that could be classified as conspiracies, but are more almost believable? Like, because they're like smaller or closer to you, sort of thing. Here's an example I'm thinking of. So, I used to listen to a lot of Fresh Air, the NPR program.
What does that sound like? Like a breeze?
Yeah, it's
an ocean open the door breeze. And just let it go. It's on anytime.
I think it's pretty obvious that Terry Gross is a like bleeding heart liberal, you know.
Okay.
And I don't think that. She's never said anything about it. It's just the subject she covers and the way in which she covers them seems to be pretty obvious to me, anyway. And one of the things that she covered was in 2009 she had a guest on. His name was Jeff Charlotte. And he has written a book called The Family, The Secret Fundamentalism at the Heart of American Power. And it's about it's a contemporary book. It's about the short, like 75 year history of this group called The Family, who, apparently control things through, like Christian fundamentalism. And that's what, like, holds them together, and they have, like, it's basically a secret society that very few people know about, but they're not, like, totally closed off. Like, people have heard of this group, and
clearly they let a book be published about them.
Right, and there are a number
informal...
of
group of like-minded individuals.
Yeah, and well, there are a number of like senators and congressmen who are supposedly heavily involved, or at least, you know, somewhat connected to it. And I listened to this story, and I was totally taken in by this guy and his theory. And like, he talked about actually having been to the house that a lot of these guys live in on C Street when they're in session, and you know, all this sort of stuff. And I thought, wow, this really is going on. There's really conspiracy. And I got a little further away from it. Just, you know, through time, it just sort of slipped from my mind. And then I thought, you know, that's kind of silly. Like, that there's this group out there who controls all this stuff and is, like, cultish. And they have members in, you know, the House and the Senate. And like, I don't know. I just don't... Having had like the nice you know, fresh air, if you will, of time to consider this, I now think that it's just, you know, one of these conspiracies.
But I think that's, you hit on the core points of what makes for a good conspiracy, right? Is that one is that it explains a lot of information, right? It makes things make so much more sense. It seems like such a more plausible explanation than what might be the truth, and it's just believable enough but hard to prove that it sticks around, right? So I think that's probably true of a lot of these, is that, you know, you have especially high-profile events where you know that there would be motives to be presented in a certain way and, you know, that sort of thing. they breed this kind of stuff, right? So there's conspiracy theories about what happened with Osama bin Laden. There's conspiracy theories, you know, about 9/11. You know, each side of the aisle creates a conspiracy about any given event that, you know, when someone farts and, you know, a consulate and somewhere else in the country and someone didn't approve it, it's like, oh, well, someone was in on this, right? But I think it's because we just lack, we think we lack information, and a lot of times it could just be, you know, just plausible enough, you know, that it's that's what makes it stick around. But that's, I don't know if I get, I think I'm just too skeptical by nature for a lot of this stuff, like that I probably end up not believing some stuff that actually is true because it just seems too far-fetched. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, absolutely. Mm.
But I think that's just, that's the way, anytime someone presents me with something that seems, because like this example, the family, as I mentioned, right? Like if they were that powerful, would they want people to know they existed, right? Would they allow someone to publish a book about it, or would they just make that person disappear, right?
Or is that what they want you to think?
Right, right. Exactly. Are there like 16 layers of this thing? I don't know.
Right.
But they're not really the family. There's the conclave.
Well, or maybe they don't necessarily think that they're doing anything wrong, so they have nothing necessarily to hide.
But why would they need to be secret then?
Maybe they don't look at it as being secret. Maybe they look at it
because
being effective.
It's not necessarily, here, to use an example.
Sure.
Freemasonry. Okay.
Okay.
Which I'm a member of.
Compasses, I believe.
Yeah, squares and compasses, okay. Yes. Yeah. But here's the thing. The organization in and of itself is not a secret organization. You can look up where a lodge is in pretty much any locality, and you know, chances are you can just knock on the door.
Dinner there. That's right.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. They have spaghetti dinner. They meet. They do whatever. Mm-hmm. When you are in session, it's closed off, and what transpires there is of nobody else's business but our own. Mm-hmm. Just as much as you know, somebody at home really should have the same liberty.
Mm-hmm. Maybe you should tell us a little bit more about that, Ben.
I mean, that's there's not really, here's the other thing, of course, that always makes it sound like we're just hand waving, but really there's not that much to know in that regard. Mm-hmm. You know, generally the secrets we share among each other are the secrets of like how the finances of our, you know, our lodge are doing, you know, membership and that sort of thing. Just, it's that kind of thing. And then in addition, we also pledge an oath to each other, just like most friends do in that sense.
Sure.
About helping and aiding and all that stuff. In this case, it's highly formalized, but it's essentially the same commitments that friends and close people make to each other all over the world. Mm-hmm. Now, the funny part about it is the people who have had membership in Freemasonry have a better chance of having been a U.S. president than most people. Mm-hmm. And that kind of thing sounds fishy.
Mm-hmm. And how much of that is the history of it?
I can't explain it. I don't pretend to understand why.
Right, where does the causality come from, right? Like, is it being in the Masons that's causing you to do that? Or is it because you're already a person with influence, you just join the Masons because it helps you network
or
with people who have influence?
I would say it's probably more of that type of thing.
Right.
The sort of the fraternity thing, especially in the 1700s and 1800s, was something that men of leisure did.
Mm-hmm.
That was just, you had time to commit to that sort of thing, so you did. Mm-hmm. And it just so happens that everybody else who has, you know, money and some other connections, you know, they were in on it too. And the other thing was that obviously the principles of membership were of certain moralities and not necessarily of other qualifying characteristics. So the baseline of paying dues is pretty low. It's not very expensive to join. It's more about, you know, the type of person you are and what you want to do in the world. Boom.
Mm-hmm.
So the idea that a man is a Mason, whether you know anything else about them, is kind of, you know, is a big plus, because you know that they are, you know, they're going to be honest. They're going to be true to their word. They're going to be good to you. And they believe in not just personal gain.
Mm-hmm.
Is the other nice thing about it. It's not about profiting for the individual so much as benefiting, you know, the community, the bonds of brotherhood, all that stuff.
Right. If you want that side of it, they have these clubs already. They're called country clubs. I used to work at one.
Sometimes,
that's the
just
way
as exclusive.
A lot of that stuff kind of like flows between each other. And honestly, a lot of Freemasons started country clubs because they were millionaires, whatever. Mm-hmm. Like, or Shriners or that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. I mean, it just, that's just the way it worked. Honestly, nobody's a millionaire now, so that those days are over. But
well, Ben, here's the one thing I do want to know, though. I want to know where you're hiding
Jimmy Hoffa. Ark of the Covenant.
The descendant of Christ.
Oh, oh, that's the one thing we can't ask about, though. We don't want to know that.
That's the lost symbol.
Oh, come on.
Or I don't know whichever one it is.
Come
I don't
on.
Know.
What do you have? The square. You have the what? The hammer.
Compasses.
The compass.
It's, doesn't it?
We have a yeah, we have a gavel. Yeah.
It's somewhere. It's probably the puck that the gavel hits.
That might be it.
I've heard a rumor.
I mean, there's a lot of those signs and stuff, and that's fun. And I also, honestly, I like the mythology that Masonry has created around itself, that it's like directly descended from, you know, ancient Egypt and all this stuff. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, the bonds between those things, if you look at the actual historical facts of the fact that most of the stories in the Bible aren't true.
What? What?
At least in this world, which tends to be one of the core principles that a lot of Freemasonry stuff is built on. You kind of have to say, okay, so the bonds between us and like Pythagoras are tenuous at best. Mm-hmm. But it's fun to think that way. And I think it's as much an ideological bond as anything else. And that's sort of the important part.
This is actually a really good point to kind of bring back to what we were talking about before. Someone had mentioned that they'd like to see more research available. And our response was, well, you know, the conspiracy theories won't go away. I think this is a really good example of an organization that has made themselves a lot more public. If you can research, and I spent a good deal of time preparing for just our conversation today, researching modern Freemasonry in the Chicago area, you can find a lot of very detailed, open information. There's bloggers who are openly like, I'm a Freemason. This is what we, you know, we're talking about. You know, one guy was talking about his dwindling membership at their specific lodge. And it's, I mean, there's all sorts of information out there. It doesn't do anything to hurt the conspiracy theorists, though.
Yeah, yeah, it's true. It's kind of interesting, though, because honestly, there's as many people, not as many, but there are some, members of Freemasonry who are just as enthralled with the conspiracy things as people on the outside, as it were.
I would imagine just that's a recruiting tool.
Absolutely.
That, like,
there's a certain allure. Yeah, you get the sort of Dan Brown thing. It's not something that, like, if you were, like, really into it and that, like, if you were weird about it, we wouldn't let you in just because you're... Honestly, you will be disappointed and you'll stop showing up after a month.
But I mean, don't you think that could result in, be part of the reason why, like, this greater openness, it being cheap to get in and you can just pay to get in? Don't you think some of that is driving the reduction in membership and that, like, it's not as exclusive or elite or, you know, secretive?
There's actually been some talk about that.
Subscribe to
it,
like, a magazine or something, you know, like,
which is funny because they actually publish magazines. But the membership issue is a good one. I think it has a lot to do with visibility and just the fact that, honestly, I don't think they're visible enough. Mm-hmm. And the other thing is, at some point, really what happened was the 60s. The 60s is what started to kill Freemasonry. Because joining a fraternity became the least cool thing you could do on the planet Earth because your dad and your grandpa were doing it. Mm. Now, they were Masons. Everybody else got hip and stopped joining and tuned out, you know, that kind of thing. And it's not a knock on it. I totally understand why. But at the same time, like, that type of thing and fitting, and everybody still assimilates in their own ways, but that type of fitting in stopped being alluring to kids or alluring to young men.
I feel like that pairs well, too, with... They don't allow atheists to join the Freemasons. That's one of the core tenets.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, there's some older things. I am probably the most most liberal Mason you'll ever meet. So
what we're saying is that there was a second shooter, the moon landing was faked,
right,
by the family.
Neil Armstrong was actually in Dallas
at the time.
He was the second,
and not on the moon, even though those things never happened.
The Freemasons did make it to the moon, but they covered it up.
Actually, Buzz Aldrin Buzz Aldrin did have a plaque from the Grand Lodge of Texas, and he has placed it on the moon.
Well, there's that.
It's technically Masonic territory or something. I don't know. And Michael Collins and Neil Armstrong are not Masons, so they couldn't hold lodge on the on the surface of the moon, but that would be amazing. That would be hilarious. Anyway.
My entire experience with secret societies can be summed up by a film called Skulls. Skulls.
Yeah. Oh,
yeah. The classic. Skull. That's a good one.
Yeah. With Paul Walker, I think, and...
And Dawson's Creek himself.
Yeah, the Dawson.
No, not Pacey. Dawson. It's
Pacey.
Pacey, yeah. Joshua Jackson. I would like to refer our listening public to some research materials that they can find on YouTube a little bit, but it has not yet come to Netflix. And I just want to remind those of you who remember that the Illuminati played a large part in the history of gargoyles. So once Gargoyles comes to Netflix finally and we can all sit down and watch it, I think we're gonna find a lot of answers there.
Yeah, finally. Yeah.
I mean, it's how Xanatos made his millions of dollars.
Release the information, Netflix. What are you trying to hide?
He went back in time in the future and then sent himself a coin through the Illuminati Society, which he sold and made gajillions of dollars.
I love that you are, not weirdly, I love that you're just totally infatuated with gargoyles.
He's 100%
these
committed.
Many years after the fact.
Yeah.
Well, it's a really good show, guys.
I believe you. What's that from? That's from Warner Brothers at the same time they were doing like Batman
Disney.
The animated series, right? Oh,
it's owned by
right.
Disney.
It was counter
yeah.
to that.
That's why it's not on Netflix.
Yeah.
That's all. Yeah.
Yeah,
well,
but
that's also
they're working on it, I'm sure.
Okay. Yeah, because well, I thought
for
they
you,
had
I
sort
hope
of...
that they are.
I hope so, too.
For your sake, your sanity. Yeah. Can't get by an Ultimate Spider-Man alone.
No, man cannot subsist on Ultimate Spider-Man. So like we always do, we want to head around the panel and get some smart suggestions. Let's talk to Ben first.
I seem to be going first pretty frequently.
I don't, okay.
I don't
all
mind.
Right, let's...
I don't
no,
mind, I'll
cut.
Bring it.
We're not even doing you today. Let's go.
I have a really good suggestion, though.
All right, Ben, go ahead.
All right, good. All right, I, besides confessing my affiliation with the Dark Lord of the... Whatever.
The square.
Voldemort?
I've also been... Yeah, the square encompasses. The thing I am most into right now is Twitter, as you may know. And I've been kind of pushing that a little bit this week. And one of the things I really think is awesome is finding new people to follow. And I think for a lot of people who are new to Twitter, they don't really know who to follow because not necessarily everybody's friends are already on Twitter. But there is a cool app called Discover People, and Discover is spelled kind of in that crappy techie way where there's no E at the end, so it's Discover. And it's Discover. They do a couple of different things. They have like a Discover Music and a Discover Apps, and this one's called Discover People, and it's a pretty lightweight app for iPhone. You basically can punch in any username, and for example, I can pull up myself right now. And what it does is it pulls up this cool little web of the people that you interact with most frequently. And then from there, you can tap on any of them, and it just expands further to you can see exactly who's talking to whom across the social networks. So like it's kind of like, oh, well, I like this one guy. Let me see who he likes or who he's interacting with, that kind of
nice.
Thing. It's a really good way to kind of generate... on, you know, to really build your feed and to make it kind of what you like. And to find what other people like in addition. So you kind of, I don't know, I feel like I kind of build bonds with people. It's kind of nice.
It's literally like a social network.
Yeah, a social web.
It's
yeah.
a visualization tool. Mm-hmm. Let me put it that way.
All right, moving on. Let's talk to Ed and get his smart suggestion. Ed.
Yep. My smart suggestion this week is... a website/app called Mighty Text. And from what I understand from the other podcast members who all use the Apple line of products, it's something similar to something Apple already does, but I have an Android, so I use this with my Android. And it interfaces really nicely with your Chrome browser, and I think probably other browsers, but I use Chrome. and your Android phone. So it puts all of your texts in one place, which is great for people like myself where I forget to bring my phone a lot of times when I go to work or something like that. Puts all your texts there. You can send texts right from your web browser just like you're chatting. It'll tell you when you're getting a phone call or you've missed a call. It'll tell you your battery life on your phone, how much battery's left on it if you don't have it near you. Super helpful, especially if you're not good at texting on your actual phone. I spend a lot of time actually just texting from my browser. Let's give you an example. My girlfriend went to work the other day and took my car, and my phone was in the glove box. And I told her, it's in the glove box, you know, like I need to get it before you leave, but I didn't. And she tried to call me to tell me she was coming home later. And obviously I wouldn't have known that she tried to call me because my phone was in the glove box of the car she was driving. But because I was on my computer, it popped up, said I had an incoming call from her, and I was able to send her a text that said, hey, I don't have my phone, which is kind of funny. She's getting a text message from me when I don't have my phone. But it's really easy to use. There's a couple different views you can use, and, you know, check it out.
Seems Mighty pretty text. Handy.
Nice.
It is super, super handy.
Cool. Moving on. Jim, give us a smart suggestion.
So I'm always looking for free education tools, free education resources online, and recently I've been dedicating a lot of my time to writing, so finding a good, strong writing professor and writing course online was a focus for me. I was able to find Brandon Sanderson. He was actually probably most well-known right now for being the writer who completed the most recent Wheel of Time book after Robert Jordan passed. And great writer, really strong in that kind of science fiction fantasy community. But he teaches at Brigham Young, and from last year, I think it was probably the winter semester of 2012, all of his courses, from start to finish, aside from like group projects, are posted online under the YouTube username Write About Dragons. So you can catch all of his classes there if you want to follow along. He makes it really easy to do. Some of them are a little longer than need to be. Some are fantastic, though, and really strong resource.
That's awesome. You know, Jordan, who couldn't be with us today due to, I don't know, he's like kicking
lay
babies
problems
or something. he, that's terrible. He doesn't kick babies. He lightly pats them. He's a big fan of these online learning resources as well. He's recommended a couple. And I just wonder about, like, how do you stick with it? What's your method? How do you stick to going to class when you know you don't have to?
You need to be, like, the only way these programs work. Well, there's two ways. One, if you're just that personality, I'm not going to start this program if I'm not going to finish it. It's just, he's got a lot to offer. I think it was a 9 or a 12-week course, and I'm already to the final course, I think. But the other way to get people to stay in and stay engaged, even if they're not part of an actual class, is the gamification that happens with a lot of these. So I think a lot of the best courses you'll find will have kind of a gaming structure to them. Even if it's nothing like a game, that'll have a reward structure, you'll build experience or something. Khan Academy has it. I'm not sure what the new name, but it originally was called Code Academy. They do something similar as well. There's a lot of different ways that people incentivize continuing to learn on their platforms. But if you
get like achievements and stuff.
Yeah, like badges, same
basic
Foursquare, you know?
Nice. Mm-hmm. Okay, cool. Well, we will check that out. And last is me. I'll go since everyone else
must.
Is already gone. Yeah. I don't know if you've noticed during the course of this podcast, but I'm especially tired today. And that, I believe, is in large part because I've been having trouble sleeping lately. And so in order to try and, I don't know, figure out where this, you know, this sort of semi-insomnia is coming from, I went on and found a couple of apps to look around with. And one that I found is an app called Sleep Cycle. It's for iPhone. And there are some really nice features about it. The main thing that it does is you plug it in and you set it on the corner of your bed in the evening, and it uses the accelerometer inside your phone to determine how deep asleep you are based on your movements. And
so your phone watches you while you sleep? Is that what you're saying? You can
kind
point
of.
The phone at you and it okay.
It's well, you don't the point camera, it at though. You. It just uses the accelerometer. So it you lay it on the mattress, and as you move, the phone moves.
I see.
And then it gives you a nice graph in the morning of how you slept, where it shows you, one axis, it shows you the time, and the other axis is how asleep you were or awake you were. And it also gives you the ability to make little notations about the things that you did throughout the day so that maybe you could improve some of those things. Like, did you drink coffee today? Yes, I did. Did you drink tea today? And you can customize all of that. One of the things I did was sometimes I'll fall asleep on the couch and get like 2 hours on the couch and then go to bed. And the phone's not going to record that. So I made a little note saying, oh yeah, I fell asleep earlier. And so basically it's just some of the same stuff that I think Ed was talking about his Fitbit does. And it just tracks some of that information, and it supposedly works with Runkeeper, which is another app/data collecting site that I've used before, but I can't figure out how to get it to work. So I don't know. Look for that in the future, I guess, maybe. but it's a nice little tool, and the main idea behind it is also that it tries to wake you up at the optimal time. I have discovered that it's really annoying, so I mostly just use my regular alarm, but I still use it to track how I've been sleeping. So here's hoping that it helps a little bit.
That's interesting. I would like to test it, because I was gonna say the one thing that it can be really, I would warn people against if they're doing this sort of thing, can be kind of disappointing, is when you think you don't get good sleep, and then your sleep aid tells you that you sleep like a stone. So my Fitbit, basically what it does is it tracks similarly. It's on you put it on your wrist, and then when you move at night, it pays attention, right? So it keeps track of sort of how you moved and how long it took you to like stabilize again. It's measuring itself stabilizing. And it would be like, you slept for 9.5 hours and you were awake in this time period for 5 minutes, like prior to starting and right when you got up. Like,
right.
And you did not, you know, and I'm like, man, I still feel tired. But yeah, so it might not solve all your problems, but it's worth checking out. And that's why I'd like to do some cross-validation with a different app to see if it's just the Fitbit that's like that or not.
Yeah, absolutely. And this one, I don't know if it's available for Android or anything, but it is available in the App Store, I think, for 99 cents. So it was kind of worth the investment just to try it out. It's hard to argue with that. So, so there you have it. Graphs of sleep. Sleep cycle. Get it. So, this is traditionally where we'll do the last word. Ed, do you want to, like, just record yourself and then, like, toss it in?
I can try to just read it here.
Yeah.
It might be fun to get reaction from people to it. So.
Okay, you're welcome to.
All right.
You don't have to talk during it, but if you find it funny, you know, you could laugh.
Sure.
That's fine.
Absolutely. Okay. So I'll just throw it to you then.
Sure. I'll do my best.
Okay. So just like we announced last week, we're going to do our segment Last Word. For this week's Last Word, we turn to Ed for the last word.
Thank you, Dean. By now you've probably heard that the U.S. Postal Service plans to discontinue mail delivery on Saturdays. Makes everybody sad, I'm sure. Postal officials cite a lack of funding as their primary reason for the cut in the service. And I think I have a solution to their problem. Military drone technology. That's right. Drones aren't just for indiscriminately killing terrorists anymore. These autonomous angels of death might just make the perfect mailmen. First off, they're cheap. In fact, you can buy one online right now for about $200, which I can only imagine is about an honest week's worth of work for your average postal worker. What's more, drones don't need to sleep, pay off a mortgage, and they don't have any little drones at home to feed. Secondly, they're easy to operate. Any idiot can fly one. All you need is an iPhone. Why hire qualified drivers and pay benefits when this country is just lousy with apathetic teenagers who work for minimum wage? Better yet, don't hire anyone at all. Make it a game and put it on the App Store. Farmville, Second Life. People are more than happy to do mundane tasks in the virtual world, as long as it means they don't have to do them in real life. Think about it. People spend literally millions, that's right, millions of hours flinging birds at pigs. Why not instead fling packages at porches, right? That's just efficiency. The biggest complaint most people have about mail service is all the junk mail. We sometimes feel that we're almost buried under a figurative pile of it. Now, I don't think it's smart business for the post office to stop doing junk mail altogether. That's where a lot of their revenue comes from. But how exciting would it be if the junk mail could literally rain down on you from the sky? sort of like what a post office commercial might look like if it were directed by R. Kelly.
Settling.
Yes, drones aren't plagued by the limitations of traditional postal carriers. What that means for the consumer is no more retrieving mail or packages from your mailbox or your front step. Imagine this scenario. It's 3 a.m., you're in bed, possibly fooling around a bit with your spouse, when bam, your Amazon package comes screaming through your window at 700 feet per second. That's convenience. Now that I think about it, who says you even have to have your mail delivered to your home address? With a simple GPS-enabled bracelet, and for a nominal fee, of course, your mail could literally be delivered to you anytime, anywhere. In traffic, on the toilet, in a business meeting, no problem. Can't wait until you get home to get your Sports Illustrated swimsuit issue? Now you don't have to. You can allocate Upton about 10 times faster, provided you can survive the impact of a rolled-up magazine blasting your solar plexus. Convenience indeed. Yep, with drones in charge.
At any cost.
All you get is a payload of productivity and leisure time. And I don't know about you, but that makes me feel that much more American. And it certainly gives new meaning to the term airmail. Think about it.
That does it for this week's podcast. We want to thank you for listening, and as always, you can find us on iTunes, on Stitcher, at our blog, which is stuffsmartpplike.com, and on Twitter at smartpplike. So for Stuff Smart People Like,
I'm Ben.
I'm Ed.
I'm Jim.
And I'm Dean. We think it's smart, so should you.